You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio.
On the evening of September 6, 2023, in Wilson Hall, MSU Bozeman's Ivan Doig Center presented a talk by noted Western writer Stephen Trimble about his memoir, The Mike File, A Story of Grief and Hope. The Mike File is about his older brother Mike and the shaping of his family by Mike's mental illness during an era of inadequate understanding, diagnosis, treatment, or mental health resources. Stephen Trimble is introduced by Janet Orr, director of the Ivan Doig Center.
To the Ivan Doig Center's first presentation for the academic year. Tonight's topic is Stephen's new book about his brother's struggle with mental illness and a memoir of his uncovering this family story. And it seemed to me that this was quite a deviation from the many, many books he's already written. He is a Westerner who was born and educated in Colorado, and he's a person with very wide interests and experience. He has I don't know what your undergrad is in, but it sounds like it's a liberal arts undergrad, English.
Officially psychology, but actually more English and biology than psychology.
I love how you tied together that kind of background with the master's in ecology, and then you had such an incredible, diverse array of experiences and occupations that really, I think, in many ways, illuminate the West and Westerners. Mm-hmm. So he was a park ranger, he's been an editor, a photographer, a teacher, and most important for us tonight, a writer and an author of over 20 books. And these books have an astonishing array of topics when I looked at it, especially considering that the memoir is what you were talking about tonight. But he's written on natural histories of the West, American Indians and their arts, particularly in the Southwest, national park booklets, books on natural history writing, novels, childhood and nature, and art and photography, and now this new genre added to your list. I was impressed. Along the way, he's accrued many awards, perhaps too many to enumerate here, but the one that I wanted to point out was for this book tonight, he's won the 2022 Human Relations Mental Health Awareness Book of the Year. So we're going to hear Stephen talk about a story about his brother tonight, but I think you're also going to be hearing a story about Montana and its peoples as well. Because this story is tied to Montana and Montana peoples. His family came from Butte. His great uncle was the well-known mid-century novelist Myron Brinig. And anyone from Butte knows that. And so what I think tonight you're truly seeing a speaker who fits the mission of the Ivan Doig Center, which is to understand and illuminate the lands and peoples of the North American West. And he covers a vast array of that, and he covers it in the most broad sense. So with that introduction, please welcome Stephen Trimble.
Thank you, Janet. As part of that, I'm going to start with a few pictures to kind of tell you a little bit about where this all starts. This really kind of tells you where it starts. Janet referred to my great-uncle Myron Brinig, and this is the facade of the Butte Silver Bow Public Archives on the hill over in Butte that features a quote from Myron. Silver Bow was rugged and harsh, but it had a certain unpremeditated beauty. Always you fought it with your heart, this raw American mining camp. That's a quote from Myron's book, Wide Open Town, which is a classic of Montana literature that hardly anyone remembers at this point. Myron realized he was gay in about 1914 in Butte, which was a remarkable thing for someone to figure out about themselves and take action on it. This is my mother's uncle, and he moved from Butte to New York and started working in the silent film industry and ended up eventually publishing more than 20 novels. This is Myron in his prime when he was living in New Mexico, and according to one of my older friends, when I lived in New Mexico, he lived a very naughty life and had affairs with every man and woman in sight. The perhaps best-known kind of remnant of Myron's work was this movie, The Sisters, also about Butte, based on his book, which was made in the 30s with Errol Flynn and Betty Davis. I got to know Myron when he was in his 90s, in the 1980s, and went to visit him in New York in his flamboyant apartment where he lived with his partner. And over about 10 years, Myron and my mother had this really rich correspondence, and Myron also wrote to me. And so the trigger for this trip to Montana is to take this box I have of correspondence between Myron and our family and my mom's collection of his out-of-print books and deliver them to the archives in Butte tomorrow, where they want them, which is great. And so Myron died in 1991, and his partner insisted that this picture run with a photo credit for me in the Times, in the New York Times. The New York Times typically does not do photo credits in obituaries, but Myron's partner insisted, so that was fun for me. So how did the Brinigs get to Montana? Well, my great-grandfather, Moses Brinig, brought the family, and my mother's, the other side of my mother's family, the Knoffels, also came to Butte around late 1890s, early 1900s. And this is the family home that still stands on Granite Street where the Brinigs lived. I don't have a picture of my great-grandfather, Moses Brinig, but I have this picture of his wife, Rebecca, standing with her daughter, Sarah. And there were a whole bunch of kids. Myron wrote books that were loosely based on our family and told great stories and wrote a couple of unpublishable autobiographies, all of which I have as my resource for family stories. Myron described his mother, Rebecca, as the Romanian gypsy Jew. She does look a little bit like she has some gypsy in her. And so their son, Myron, was my great uncle. Myron's brother, Saul, is my grandfather. And so this is a picture of my grandfather and grandmother in Butte with their first kid. And it turns out that Moses died young, but he kept sending out all his sons and sons-in-law around Montana to set up stores. Moses had come and set up a store in Butte, and he sent his sons to Phillipsburg and Dillon and Bozeman and Anaconda. And when it came turn for Saul, he had run a store in Dillon before he got married, and then when he got married, he was sent off to Livingston. And here's Main Street in Livingston, and that building on the right is the Danforth Building, which is now the Danforth Art Museum, and in the 1930s was the building where my grandpa had his store. And so last night, I did a reading at Wheatgrass Books, which is on the same block, and I thought that was super cool. I also learned that when my grandfather's store moved across the street, because I have some dates from the county directories, in 1937, it turns out that the Antlers Bar took over that building in 1937 and was there for 30 years. So my grandfather must have lost his lease. So my mother, Isabel, who was on the left with her two siblings, was born in Butte, but grew up in Livingston. And these are pictures of Isabel and her sister, Charlotte. And the memories that my mother had of Livingston were not about what a beautiful place it was. They were memories of being in the small town that she wanted to escape from. And so I didn't hear anything about how beautiful Livingston is or how beautiful Montana is. I heard about being one of two Jewish families in Livingston, a certain amount of anti-Semitism, and wanting to get away. My mom graduated from Park County High School in 1939, and her mother, Nancy, was determined that my mom would marry a Jewish guy, and there weren't a lot of them around. And so it turns out that there was a Jewish guy who showed up in the store. I think my mom got sort of pushed into marrying him. He was from Denver. My mom moved to Denver with him and had a child immediately, my brother Mike, and got divorced immediately after that because this guy was a bad choice. He was abusive both psychologically and physically, which I learned from their divorce papers. And 5 years later, my mom married my dad when my brother Mike was five. And so we now have a family where I have an older brother, right? I've got a big brother who I adore, who's 8 years older than me. And when Mike was a kid, he acquired his first diagnosis. Mildly retarded was the word we used in those days. He was a slow learner, and my mom was a heroic tutor. And she tutored my brother every night with his books on the yellow formica of our kitchen table and got him through the first 6 years of regular school, pretty miraculously, but she did it. And then Mike went into the very early special ed programs that one of the Denver suburbs had. And as he approached adolescence, he got really tall and he got really angry. And he was just a volcano of emotion. He became someone my parents didn't know what to do with. The school didn't know what to do with him. And the school basically told my folks they couldn't have him in school, that he was too unpredictable. And my folks didn't know where to turn. know, this is before any family therapy. Child psychology barely existed. There was certainly no National Alliance for the Mentally Ill that could have helped us. And so they did about the only thing they could think of and turned to the state mental health system. And just about that moment, something happened that I still remember that was really the vivid, visceral memory that triggered this book. And I want to read you the first few pages of the book. It'll give you a sense of what was happening in our family. I am six. I tuck between the wooden studs in the garage, folding into a ball, my hands over my ears. Buckshot sprays of angry words fly at me through the open kitchen window. Summer heat fills the garage. I stare at the stipple of oil stains on the concrete floor and monitor the dust motes as they float from lightless corners through golden sun shafts. I jam myself deeper into the corner, aching to disappear. Anything to distract from the incoming missiles, packed with anguished words. In the kitchen of our little house in the Denver suburbs, my teenage brother Mike towers over our mother, Isabel, his arms braced around her. He cages her against the wall. Mike is big, almost 6 feet tall at 14. He screams at our mother, "You love Stevie more than me. You put me in school with retards. Everyone yells at me. Everyone tells me I'm messed up. Too much trouble. Stupid. Sick." He aims his rage especially at my father, Don, who is Mike's stepfather. For Mike is Isabel's son from her brief disaster of a first marriage. "I hear you and the stepdad talking. I hear you. You want to send me away. You hate me. I hate you." Mom does her best to speak calmly to talk him down. I hide in the garage. Indeed, I hide from Mike's story for a very long time. I can reclaim only a few moments from my earliest years with my brother. I remember Mike's silly giggle and grin before his broken brain swept him away, his in-your-face enthusiasm, a giddiness with an edge, a little too ferocious, a little unsocialized, a little manic. That daunting summer afternoon in our Denver home in 1957 eclipsed any other joyful memories. A few days after Mike's searing confrontation with our mother, my parents, at wit's end, admitted him to Colorado Psychopathic Hospital for evaluation. Mike never lived at home again, never spent a night at home again. And so Mike left, and we were able to visit him, but he was out there at the edges of our life. And over many, many years, he became a kind of mystery to me as a kid. You know, I never lived with him again, and I began to grow up. He wasn't exactly a secret, but there were secrets in our family. When I was about 10, bored, I wandered out to the garage to poke around, looking for something novel, something diverting. My dad had built three shelves across the back of the garage, stacked with boxes of seldom-used dishes, dusty suitcases, occasionally used tools, outgrown toys. My grandmother's wooden-shafted golf clubs from the 20s, short enough for me to use, each iron stamped with a quaint name, Mashie, Niblick. My dad's well-worn custom boots, ready for the endless miles he'd walk in his next field season as a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. I always found it eerie that a wooden model of his foot lived in the back room at White's Boots in Spokane, Washington, poised for his order whenever he needed a new pair. This day, I found a green metal file box I'd never noticed. The box had a locking clasp, but when I pushed down the latch, the top popped open. Inside were documents and records. Who cared about auto titles and house insurance? But there was more. Folders labeled with names. Stevie. Mike. Temptation overrode any concern about discretion. I pulled out the certificate that recorded my brother's birth. The document said that Michael David Scher had been born on December 31st, 1942, to parents identified as Isabel Virginia Brittig, 21 years old, and not Donald Trimble, my dad, but Maury Lewis Scher, 30. Line by line, these typed words burned into my brain circuitry. Our mother was married before she married my dad. The birth certificate logged a wedding in Butte, Montana, where Mom had been born into tightly connected families of immigrant Jewish retailers. I thought I knew my family. My Brittig grandparents had followed Mom from Livingston and now lived in East Denver. We saw Mom's sister, Charlotte, and her family all the time. I thought of my mother as an unchanging, dependable constant, These were the defining walls of my world. But who on earth was Maury Scher? How could I not know that Mike and I had different fathers? I felt betrayed. So I walked back in the house and asked my mom what was going on. And she just crumpled. I had discovered something that she didn't want to talk about. And working on the book, I started the book project and disappeared into what one of my writer friends calls research rapture and wrote far more about the family history than anyone would want to know. But I did track down Maury Lewis Scher's family and met some of them and actually met Mike's aunt and went to her 106th birthday party in Los Angeles and had a great time with all that research and wrote a manuscript much longer than this one that no one could get through, and people kept pushing me to get back to Mike's story. And so that's what I did. So Mike was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, capable of violence, by the courts, by the Colorado Psychopathic Hospital. He went off to the Colorado State Hospital, where he spent 9 years in the hospital system, at a time when there were 6,000 people in the Colorado State Hospital. You know, he just missed that time of lobotomies and massive doses of electroshock and chilling people down to hypothermic temperatures, thinking that all those things would help. But he got there at about the same time that Thorazine became widely used. And I'm sure that he spent a lot of his time narcotized and, you know, zombieized under that drug. There were a couple of years in there when he was able to leave the hospital, and he spent 2 years at a training center near our home in Denver and could come for dinner. And I actually saw him for a few times during that period. So that's what Mike looked like at about the time that my dad married my mom and adopted him. And he was just a sweet little kid at that point. Easy to love. That's my parents' wedding picture, Isabel and Don, in 1948. And in 1950, I came along, and we were a family. Here we are visiting my dad's mother in Washington State, Mike leaning into my dad, my grandmother holding me, and my mother looking right at the camera, pretending that she's Hedy Lamarr, and looking rather glamorous. But Mike and I grew up together in those first few years, and he just got bigger and bigger. And here he's beginning to head into that time that led to him leaving. Here are Mike's school pictures from year to year. He looked a lot like his dad. I finally found a picture of his biological dad after searching a lot. His biological dad was kind of a cipher in his family. He never remarried. He actually committed suicide much later after our mom divorced him. This is Mike and me at about the time of that incident when I was hiding in the garage. And this is Mike's last picture when he was in school. But Mike looked a lot like his biological dad, and I'm sure every time my mom looked at him, she remembered that. These pictures were taken when Mike would come back to our house during those couple of years when he could do so, when he was at the State Training Center in Wheat Ridge, our suburb. And here's Mike looking sullen and me looking extra energetic because I was trying to be the not Mike, it turns out. My parents and I were little people, and Mike was a totem pole of a person. So Mike spent all those years at the hospital, and he was really living through the sequence of events that anyone who's writing the story of mental health treatment in America would tell as a story. You know, he got there, Thorazine, and 6,000 other people. The average length of hospitalization in the 50s was 13 years, and half of the people diagnosed with mental illness were diagnosed with schizophrenia. You know, Mike almost certainly did not have schizophrenia. All of the caregivers and psychiatrists and social workers and psychologists I've talked to are absolutely sure from reading his letters and hearing these stories that he almost certainly didn't have schizophrenia. Maybe he had bipolar disorder. Maybe he was on the autism spectrum. Maybe he just had really severe depression and learning disabilities. You know, we just don't know. But Mike then lived through that time of reform of these state hospitals when we started mainstreaming all those folks who were in state hospitals back to their communities. And initially, under the urging and support of President Kennedy and a federal bill that passed to support community health centers, it was going to work great. People were going to come back to their communities. They'd have access to treatment, support from their families. But it turned out that it didn't work great because we gradually started defunding those community health centers. Until in the Reagan years, we defunded them completely and turned a lot of those folks out onto the streets as homeless people. But Mike spent another 10 years living in boarding houses or board and care homes in Denver. And when he came back to Denver, we kind of imagined that he would rejoin our family. I was in high school. He was in his 20s. This is 1966. And we kind of imagined he'd come back and sit down at the kitchen table with us and be part of our family. That was incredibly naive on our part. My parents and I thought that would happen. Mike was so angry and bitter about having been banished from our family that he would storm out every time he came for dinner, until one Thanksgiving he stormed out and did not come back. And he talked to his counselors. He was getting some counseling, and they decided that he couldn't be with us. It was too upsetting. So he cut off contact, and we didn't see him at all. And the next summer, my parents and I were off for one of my dad's field seasons. We would leave Denver every summer and rent a house in whatever town was near his field area where he was mapping geology. We spent years in Pocatello. I actually drove around Pocatello on my way up yesterday and visited some of the neighborhoods where we had lived. And Mike wrote a series of letters to my mom. The chapter about those dinners I called Chaos for Dinner. The follow-up were these letters that Mike wrote that my mother saved. I can't imagine how she read them the first time, let alone saved them. This is the first of those letters. Thursday, June 1st, 1967. To Mom. Listen, I love you and all that, but still you should have realized what you did wrong to yourself and me. You made some of the worst mistakes that any mother should ever make. You took everything out of my life. Why not you admit to yourself what you did wrong? Because you didn't get anything out of your life when you were a child. You wanted to take and mess your own son's life up entirely. Well, I'll tell you, did a darn good job of it. I don't want to ever hear from you or the stepdad. You better leave me alone entirely from now on out. I mean business. You think I am a fool. I am a lot smarter than you put me on to be. You people are sick, selfish, and very unfair. I will send you people something for remembrance. I've been better off in an orphanage after I was born because you sure didn't deserve me one bit. So leave me alone forever. I am just sorry you deprived me of everything, because if I had good frame peace of mind, I'd probably in business for myself. Today you ruined me, but have a good summer anyway. Love, Mike. And there's a series of maybe seven letters, and the letters just swing back and forth between anguish and apology with just grief all the way through. And you can imagine how our mother dealt with that. Not well. Again, one more reason why she didn't want to talk about Mike. And so Mike kind of disappeared from our lives completely. He was living in Denver. He was not on the streets. He was in boarding houses. And we exchanged birthday cards, at least through high school. I would send him a generic birthday present or Christmas present, a carton of cigarettes or aftershave or something pretty non-personal. We weren't seeing him. And we'd get a one-line answer back. I saw Mike only one more time. On a cold winter gray day in 1970, I drive through downtown Denver in our inelegant old pinkish-tan 1962 Dodge Dart. The family car now passed on to me. I'm home from college on winter break, running errands. Multi-lanes of traffic carry me down Broadway, through the heart of the city, the heart of the state. The Capitol rises to my left, its gold dome incandescent in low-angle light. Off to the right, khaki-colored grass leads past leafless, black, branching trees reaching skyward, the imposing civic center behind, steam plumes from vents, the breath of the city. A line of people stands on the curb, bundled up for winter, waiting, watching, or maybe just killing time. And there's Mike at the front of a cluster of folks at a bus stop. He wears that same scowl of unhappiness, I remember. He's a slouching column of dark tallness, a cigarette dangling from his fingers. I slow down, grip the wheel, hesitant, agitated, but can't quite get myself over to the curb. I want to stop. I'm scared to stop. My AM radio blasts The Beatles, The Long and Winding Road That Leads Me to Your Door, and Let It Be. Conflicting advice. No help there. I'm riveted to Mike as I roll by. He doesn't make eye contact. Even if he saw me, he might not recognize me. Mike wanted nothing to do with us, right? What in the world would I say? I don't pull over, roll down the window, call to him. Before I know it, I'm past, still clutching the wheel. I do not drive around the block to give myself a second chance, to push through my uncertainty, stop, park, hop out of the car, and catch Mike before he moves on, boards his bus, disappears. I let the current of traffic carry me downstream, south along Broadway, away from my brother. My recollection of this encounter moves like a scene from a movie. a YouTube video clip. It's one of those permanent memories generated when you lock onto a scene, staring so hard at someone or something that there's a taut line carrying the image right into your brain, where it remains forever vivid. After so many years of Mike existing as an abstract fact in the nether reaches of reality, without detail or motion, this chance sighting of my brother takes on the full resonance of regret. I remember the moment with utter clarity because I'm so mortified by my failure to call out to him. I simply don't have the confidence, the empathy, the kindness, the agency to stop. Last night I noticed that I chose the word regret here, and that's what I feel. A number of people have asked me if I feel guilty about my behavior with Mike, and that's not the right word. You know, I was too young. And as I say, just didn't have the agency. You know, I wasn't mature enough to have done anything like reaching out to him, stopping when I drove by. I have regret. I don't have guilt. My mother had guilt. Lots of guilt. But I don't think I did. The other interesting thing about that scene, every one of the memories that I'm reading you, those are among the very few really visceral memories I have of mine. I keep going back to them and replaying them, trying to pull out every detail I can as a writer. And the way I wrote it in the book, I saw Mike, I didn't stop, I kept going. But several years ago, I told Mike's story for the Salt Lake City version of The Moth, the NPR show, you know, real stories told live on stage without notes. And when I told the story on the stage for what we call The Bee, I drove around the block and gave myself a second chance. And Mike was gone when I came around the block. And I really don't remember whether I drove around the block or not. Either way, Mike was gone. But it's fascinating to me how I can pull out lots of details from those memories from so long ago. And some of them may or may not even be true. But that's the way it works with our memories. So that was 1970. And we didn't see Mike again. And in 1976, I was off in graduate school in Tucson. And my cousin, who lived in Denver, was a teacher in the Denver suburbs and came for dinner one night in December of 1976 to my parents' house. Cooking was an act of love for my mom, and she loved cooking for the people that she loved. And my cousin walked in toward our house and picked up the afternoon newspaper, the Denver Post, as she headed toward the front door and took the rubber band off and opened it up. And the lead story, the headline said, "Death Knocked, and only Mike was listening." And she began reading and realized that the first line said something along the lines of, "Last Friday, Michael Trimble, 33, slipped through one of the cracks in the system." Mike had died in his board and care home, probably during a seizure. His third diagnosis was epilepsy and wasn't found for 3 days. And the media, the Denver Post and the TV stations, picked up on Mike's death as an expose of these poorly supervised boarding houses that were state-funded. And my cousin Kathy walked on into the kitchen as she kept reading, and my mom did not know Mike had died. This is how our mother found out about the death of her son. And I just picture, you know, my mom cooking, my dad making the nightly gin and tonic, and Kathy arrives with this news. And Kathy said my mom just started pacing, and she was still pacing several days later when I got home. And my parents couldn't imagine a funeral or a memorial service. It would have been far too emotional. So Mike was cremated, and his ashes were spread by the mortuary, and he just kind of disappeared. And over the years, when people would ask me if I had a sibling, I would say, yeah, I had a brother older than me, a half-brother who was mentally ill. He lived in the state hospital for a while, and he died years ago. Maybe he's calling. That was my mantra, and you can imagine people didn't pursue that. You know, there was nothing else to say. My mom had a manila envelope with her block letters on the front that said Mike. And inside that manila envelope were the court records and a very few fragmentary records from the hospital and those letters that Mike sent and the yellowing newsprint of the stories about his death. And we called it the Mike file. At one point, my mom tried throwing it away, and my dad retrieved it. You know, it was too emotional for her. But my dad retrieved it and put it back in the files. And when I would come to visit from our home in Salt Lake City, periodically my dad would say, you know, Steve, you got to take the mic file and stash it away in family history. And I would always forget. It was too emotional for me, too. It was incendiary. And I hadn't really looked closely at what was in it for years. And then one time when my dad was in his 90s, he called me and said, I think I threw away the mic file by mistake. And he was beside himself. But when we cleaned out his files, just before he died, there it was. That file was deathless. It wasn't going anywhere. And so after my father died in 2011, I had the mic file in my office on my desk. And about a year after my father had died, parents have died, Mike has died, anyone would be upset about my pursuing this story. Everyone was gone. And I spilled the contents of that envelope across my desk and started reading. And as a writer, I didn't know where I was going to go, but I knew that as a writer, I knew that I had great material. It was emotional material. My buddies and my family for years had said, Steve, you know, this is the best material you have as a writer. So I started with research, which is easy. It's not emotional. Who was my mother at 20 when she married Maury in Butte on a very cold January day? Well, I went to Butte on that very same January day when I started working in the project to see what it felt like. And I went to the house where Mom's wedding happened. And I did lots of work in the archives and had a great time with all that family history. And then I began trying to research Mike in every way that I could and research the records of Mike and my parents and wrote this very long manuscript, 250 pages, that eventually got to Mike, but really didn't get to me very much. And I want to read you one last section from the book that tells you a little bit about where I end up in this journey. My mother never thought of herself as strong, but she was. Isabel beat the odds bestowed by her inheritance of an inordinate number of family sorrows. Bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, abuse, disability, depression, rejection, and lies. Alcoholism, abandonment, suicide, and madness scattered misfortune through her family and through her life. Some of that was close, some of it was quite distant. I'm grateful to mostly have avoided these calamities, the hazards that run in our genes. I'm grateful my children have as well. I didn't escape unscathed. I've opened the mic file. I've held the letters and the stories and the grief in my hands. I felt tender. I felt vulnerable. I felt fear about what I'd find, and I've realized that I defined myself in part as not Mike. I've supposed I was a simple, stable person by nature, and maybe that's true. But when I saw how hard Mike was on our family, I surely chose to be the opposite. I've ventured back into the past as the man I am now, content, in my 60s, is the way I wrote that in the book, now in my early 70s. I began with research, my comfort food. I tracked down documents, Isabel's and Maury's divorce records, Maury's death certificate, Mike's autopsy report. I untangled family history, interviewed psychiatrists and social workers and elders in the Denver and Butte Jewish communities. I tracked the evolution of mental health treatment in 20th century America. I asked obscure cousins and my difficult Aunt Charlotte to share their unvarnished memories. I met Maury Scher's surviving family. As I reconstructed Isabel's life and heritage, as I traced the parallel tracks of Mike's journey and the history of our treatment of mental illness, all these notes and words and drafts eventually brought me back to myself. Mike's life brings me closer to my own life, closer than I've ever been to knowing myself. I also realized that I never separated fully from my parents. My wife, Joanne, reading draft after draft of this book, urged me to replace all those we's with I. She kept telling me with exasperation, this book is not about we, it's about you. And I kept answering, but that's how my parents and I felt. It's a family story. But I finally got it when Joanne said, your parents could have written this. You weren't Mike's parent, you were his brother. How did you feel? I'm shocked that self-realization takes so long, but now I no longer think of myself as mostly an only child. Mike was there too, all along, shaping our family, shaping me, and his disappearance from our family was a grievous loss. I was deprived of a relationship with my brother, and that was a subtraction from what would have been a richer life for both of us. I've come in from the garage, where it turns out I've been hiding for more than 60 years. I've rejoined my family, even if many of them are gone. I've waited until I felt safe before I could own the mental illness that flares in our lineage through multiple generations. Finally, I can risk turning to each of these characters in my life with more understanding than I've ever before brought or sought. As these people from my life drift away into memory, I don't want to lose them. My fragile raconteur of a mother, my kind, fierce scientist father, my storm cloud of a brother. Generation to generation, we tumble along in a maze of family emotion and energy. The network of trails connecting these characters expands as elders die and new rounds of children appear and grow up in all of their challenging and endearing humanity. In her essay, The Empathy Exams, Leslie Jameson concludes that empathy is a choice we make to pay attention, to extend ourselves. I arrived late, but I've made my choice. So that's where I got in the book. And the subtitle of The Mike File is A Story of Grief and Hope. Plenty of grief, right? So where's the hope? And I'm finding that I'm getting to the hope even after the book has been published as I do these readings and interviews and talks like this one. And Mike becomes more and more real the more I talk about him. He's now almost a physical presence with me as I tell these stories. He's a person rather than just a diagnosis. And I think that I've managed to actually be able to say, I see you, Mike. And that's where the hope is. And I'm finding that if I transfer that to all those other folks out there who struggle with their mental health, just the fact of seeing them creates hope. It really makes a big difference. So I have a little reminder for myself when I walk along the sidewalks and I see people talking to invisible friends and ranting, or homeless people staring into space. I try to see them. I try to acknowledge them, even with just a nod, eye contact, a hello. I think it makes a difference. I do see them, and I'm actually incredibly grateful that I did this project and wrote this book. It's been an amazing journey for me, and it also feels like I've done a good job of honoring my brother. Thank you.
I was struck by the, which I don't hear too often, about the comment about how the community mental health centers were established with Kennedy. I've been in the field for 50 years as a psychologist. But then all of a sudden with the Reagan administration, how there's not a whole lot said or written about that I hear, but how a big tragedy happened. He emptied people back in the community and got rid of the area that could have supported them in the community mental health center. I hear people raving about how great he was, like with Berlin, and knocked them all down, which I think was positive. But there was nothing positive in the social area, in my opinion.
No, I think you're right. We eliminated 500,000 beds in state hospitals. Where are those people going to go? And it's really hard to get a bed when you need it now. For the first few years after that, it worked really well. The psychologists and social workers I talked to in Denver talked about the 70s being actually a really good time for being able to treat people. There were beds when they needed them. They had access. I finished the book by imagining a best-case scenario for Mike. If we did everything right, what would we have done? And I think he'd still be here if we had done that. I mean, it's so different now. We don't have what we need, but we do have child psychology and family therapy and things that didn't exist in the 50s or early 60s.
I think you could make an argument that that trauma or upset or grief that's in the family is a shadow that clouds relationships, right? And definitely did for you. The issue between your brother and your parents affected you. But how might you say that you're living through that affects your own children? What kind of burdens do they maybe even unknowingly bear because of what you and your family went through?
This is beginning to feel like a therapy session. The answer is really I don't know. I did a really good job of burying that trauma and Mike's story and being the not Mike. And so I think my kids would probably say they didn't get much of that coming through. I often do these talks in partnership with a psychologist, and one of them, who I partnered with several times, said that one of the ways to get through trauma is to put it in context. And that's what the book did for me, is to put my trauma and Mike's trauma in the context of everything in the story. I actually don't know if my kids have sat down and read the book. I think most writers find that their kids don't pay a lot of attention to their work and take it for granted and don't read the books. Maybe they'll read them years from now. But they know the story. They've heard me do this talk. And so they can put me in context with the story. I don't think they feel the need to put themselves in context with the story.
Well, it'd be interesting to ask them, too.
It would. I will.
Because they may see things transferred in families that you might not even be aware that your grief may be affecting them in ways they're not even aware of yet.
I mentioned my difficult Aunt Charlotte. My mother's sister was really toxic to all of our family. She was eventually diagnosed as bipolar, but she kind of blew up everything in her family. And boy, her kids suffered greatly. And that was all very close to my family as a kid, but pretty distant from my kids' experience. But that's about as close as that mental illness has come.
I knew you back when some of this was happening, but of course I didn't know about it then. But hearing you tonight, it's so different than just reading the book, even though I could somewhat hear you in my head as I read. But hearing you tonight, I can't help but wonder what Mike would think at this point of your book, of your long researching search. I kind of like to think he would be amazed and almost delighted.
You guys are asking questions no one has ever asked. It's really interesting. I think that he would be pleased. It's that phrase, I see you. You know, I see you, Mike.
His letters to your mother, and I think you might see all this as it's about time.
Yeah, for sure.
Now you're seeing me, now I mean.
And why couldn't you have done this?
Exactly.
Decades and decades and decades ago. I'd love to be able to have that conversation.
Did you ever get a sense that he had a community?
We knew so little about his life in Denver. In the Denver Post articles, they interviewed the guy who ran this boarding home, and he talked about Mike going away for the weekend to visit friends. I don't know who they were. Described Mike as a worrier who was always worried about his physical ailments. I guess he spent a lot of time going to doctor's appointments. There was no mention in those articles of him being mentally ill, but there was an assumption that he was just because of where he lived. The newspaper articles about his death and his not being found for 3 days led to investigations by the Denver Health Department and a chastisement of the boarding home. All they did was wrap their knuckles with a ruler, and they instituted a new system where they would check on people at breakfast and make sure that they ticked them off a list. That's all they did. And that the same thing happens over and over again. There was just an article in the Salt Lake Tribune a month or so ago about exactly the same thing happening in a care home where someone died and wasn't found for several days. And we've made so little progress.
So I guess with that story from Salt Lake you just shared, maybe that's answering it. But you're talking a lot about the Denver scene regarding mental health and different things that were accessible for Mike. In your research, did you find that was a universal kind of experience or one that was shared out west?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Mike's experience was really typical. And the organization Mental Health America rates all the states every year now in terms of their prevalence of mental illness and their access to treatment. And the Intermountain West is right at the bottom every year. Utah, Arizona, Wyoming, Idaho, right down at the bottom. Montana does better. Ranks about 20 this year. I don't know why that is, but you do rank better. My story was pretty universal, and every time I do an interview or write an op-ed that has some legs, that gets out a ways into the world about the story, I get emails and messages back from people who want to tell me the story of their own family, struggling with a sibling, parent, a kid, where they lived through something very similar, which often ends in horrific tragedy. The one thing I didn't experience that so many other people have experienced is having Mike live for decades or having a sibling with schizophrenia live for decades where you just keep getting calls from the police in the middle of the night and that person is on the streets and off the streets and it's just this endless cycle of grief and sadness. And we didn't experience that.
He had so many long-term side effects and he apparently was on it for several years, it sounds like. I wonder if he was still on that, or if his death was related somehow.
I can't know. The state hospital destroyed all their treatment records in the 80s, and I couldn't track down any records of Mike's treatment in Denver after he came back. All I can do is guess. The newspaper articles kept referring to Mike's autopsy, and so I thought one day, sitting at my desk, well, there must be an autopsy record. And so I called the Denver medical examiner, and the woman I got on the phone said, oh yeah, we'd have that. And while I have her on the phone, she just walks to the back room and plucks it out of a filing cabinet and sent me the PDF the next day of Mike's autopsy, which was really something to read. You know, it's the story of the evisceration of my brother, documented organ by organ. The coroner did find evidence of brain deterioration and used words that are no longer used anymore. And I took the autopsy report to a pathologist up at the University of Utah.
it was really hard to figure out cause and effect. There were literally holes in his brain, but there was no way to tell whether they sort of caused his mental illness or whether his mental illness led to those. She could see evidence of trauma. She didn't know when that would have happened. And very much like the coroner said, the cause of death was unclear, but probably during a seizure. But you couldn't say for sure. Oh, the Thorazine, right. And so I asked her why there was no evidence of Thorazine or any other psychotropics in his body, and she said it was expensive to test for those, and they wouldn't have tested for them unless there was some reason to. He was on some anti-seizure medication.
I appreciate your honesty as you were talking about your reaction, your response as you were driving through Denver and there was Mike. I love how human it is. As a mother, two small children, and teaching them empathy and all the pressures of the world and our own experience, I think it's really valuable, your process and the honesty with that. And from my own experience, I have an uncle, probably in his late 60s now, and he was always like my weird Uncle Fred. He clearly really struggled. Everyone said he had delusions of grandeur, and he worked as a telemarketer, but was always saying he had the next big idea, was going to make all this money. And it was really sad at family events like Thanksgiving where he was there, but no one would really talk to him. That culture, that family culture that's so thick, don't talk to Uncle Fred because you'll get cornered. For me as this young girl, it was so sad to feel that and to feel this sort of ostracization of him. It was like this cloak. Don't go there. And we lived with this, and we're still living with it, and his son, and the impact of that.
Yeah, I think it's pretty universal. I mean, there are a lot of families that have a Mike of some kind in their family. His dad, Maury, I think was a weird uncle, too, in his family. I found one guy in Maury's family who was the youngest of his generation, so he was still alive. And he remembered Maury as someone who would only talk to the kids. He didn't talk to the adults when he would come to family events. This guy that I was interviewing thought Maury was kind of cool. He remembered him being rather dashing, who traveled a lot. And I think that was because Maury was only talking to the kids, because the parents, the adults, for some reason, did not want him around. And many of the people in that family, you know, didn't remember that he even existed, let alone that Mike existed. At the time of the divorce, I don't think that he had access to Mike in the divorce papers. He was supposed to pay child support. The next court document, several years later, that my mom initiated, my mom didn't talk about this, but I found them in the records. My mom took him to court to try to get the child support money that he was not paying. And I don't think he ever came back to see Mike, ever. But when Mike came back to Denver in 1966, when he was in his 20s, he looked up his real dad, and several of the letters that he wrote to mom talked about finding his real dad and detailing those interactions. And he actually counts the number of days that he saw him, and then Maury rejects him. And so that's one more trauma for Mike. In the letters, he basically says to my mom, "You were right. My real dad rejected me." So he resented his stepdad. His biological dad rejected him. Mike just had such a hard go of it.
How did your dad, the stepdad?
Remarkably well, from my perspective always. He was a loving dad when Mike was little. He adopted Mike immediately. But in all of my vast research that is not in the book, I interviewed one of our old family friends, who was one of my dad's closest buddies, after my dad had died, but his friend was still alive in his 90s. And he said that my dad had a lot of trouble dealing with Mike, something along those lines. It sounded to me like my dad talked more to him about it, probably with more emotion than he might have talked about it with my mom. My dad hated to reveal emotion, and he could be really tough. I mean, that was back in the day when parents spanked their children, and as Mike got bigger and bigger, Mike was over 6 feet, my dad was 5'7", and my dad was fierce, but that wasn't going to work very well. And so one more reason why Mike left. Thank you all for coming.
You have just heard a talk by Stephen Trimble about his memoir, The Mike File, A Story of Grief and Hope, published by Homebound Publications in their Little Bound Books series. It was a presentation by the Ivan Doig Center of MSU Bozeman on September 6, 2023. You can find out more at www.stephentrimble.net. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire, for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman. Thanks to Drs. Suzanne and Arliss Wood for production assistance.